people that are too precious about their ideas, I as an investor wouldn't bet on them, because what you gain in pressure testing your own ideas, even in your own internal development and ability to communicate it, far outweighs the risk of idea theft.
All right, welcome back, or welcome to the Finding Mastery Podcast. I'm Michael Gervais, and by trade and training, a sport and performance psychologist, as well as the co-founder of Compete to Create. And the whole idea behind these conversations is to learn from people who are on the path of mastery, who have committed their life efforts towards mastery of self and mastery of craft. And we want to better understand not only their insights about their craft, which is good because we can hopefully apply those in our own life, but at the deeper level, we want to understand how they've approached mastery of self. How do they use their own inner life and their mind and the whole thing to be able to explain and make sense of the world around them? Finding Mastery is brought to you by Facet. When we think about what it takes to thrive and to live a life of flourishing, there's no doubt that financial wellness is a big part of that equation. There's lots of ways to manage your money, and here's one that you might be interested in. Facet is the next generation of personalized financial planning. They're on a mission to make expert financial advice accessible to the masses. So Facet provides you with flexible access to a team of financial planners and a team of experts across retirement planning, tax strategy, estate planning, and more. And the best part here is that instead of taking a percentage of your portfolio, Facet only charges an affordable flat membership fee and doesn't charge you to invest with them. This is extremely rare for the industry. As you probably know, most financial advisors charge you a percentage of your assets. And even if it's only 1%, those fees can really add up over the course of your lifetime. And because you're listening to this podcast, Facet is hooking you up with a great offer. When you sign up today, Facet will waive the $250 enrollment fee for new annual members. And they have an epic limited time offer on top of that. To learn more, just head to facet.com/FM. Again, this one is a little different. That's Facet, facet.com/FM, to waive your enrollment fee and to learn more about their limited time offer. A little disclosure here. Facet Wealth Inc., Facet, is an SEC registered investment advisor headquartered in Baltimore, Maryland. This is not an offer to sell securities or investment, financial, legal, or tax advice. Past performance is not a guarantee of future performance. Terms and conditions apply. Finding Mastery is brought to you by Bubs Naturals. Like you, I am mindful about what I put into my body. So for me, it usually comes down to ingredients and simplicity. The shorter the list, the better. And that's why I've been loving Bubs Naturals. Bubs creates products with high quality, all natural ingredients that are designed to help us get after the adventures in life. For years, I've been a huge fan of their Hydrate or Die electrolyte mix. I mean, that's a fun title for a product, isn't it? It only has 6 total ingredients. It's packed with electrolytes. I love the taste. No added sugar, no artificial flavors, none of that stuff. It's great for post-workout recovery. That's when I use it. And I also use it during long periods of travel, which I've been doing a lot lately. And so thank you for the hydration here. And a ton of athletes that I know swear by them too. They're currently in just about every MLB locker room. They work closely with the Red Sox, the Yankees, I know the Rangers, Cardinals, Diamondbacks, and many more, of course. I'd love for you to go check them out. I think they're doing a really nice job. Just head to bubsnaturals.com/findingmastery and enter the code findingmastery at checkout for 20% off your first purchase. Again, that's Bubs Naturals, bubsnaturals.com/findingmastery with the code findingmastery for 20% off your first purchase. Now, this week's conversation is with Raja Deer. He's the co-founder and the co-CEO of Seed Health, a microbial sciences company pioneering applications of bacteria to impact human and environmental health. Okay, some of you might be really familiar with the microbiome. And those who aren't, let me share a brief summary that I think really ties it up well. And it's from Harvard School of Public Health. And as many of you know, that I've been fascinated with the microbiome for a long time and its impacts not only on health, but also for performance. So here's what they had to say. Picture a bustling city on a weekday morning. The sidewalks flooded with people rushing to get to work or to appointments. Now imagine this at a microscopic level, and you have an idea of what the microbiome looks like inside our bodies, consisting of trillions of microorganisms, also called microbiota or microbes, of thousands of different species. These include not only bacteria, but fungi, parasites, and viruses. In a healthy person, these, what we call bugs, coexist peacefully, with the largest numbers found in the small and large intestines, but also throughout the body. The microbiome is even labeled a supporting organ because it plays so many key roles in promoting the smooth daily operations of the human body. And so this is where Raj's company, Seed, comes into play. Seed partners with leading scientists to translate breakthrough science into live biotherapeutic and innovations for consumer health, with a portfolio targeting conditions where bacteria can become or replace the primary standard of care. Cool as that. Talk about disruption. And Seed developed scientifically validated next-gen probiotics with a mission to bring much-needed precision, efficacy, and education to the global probiotics market. It's really a wild west out there right now for probiotics. And so Roger believes that, you know, the magic happens at the intersection of technology, systems biology, and translational science. And he's got a unique way of thinking, and he follows those thoughts with action. And that's what this conversation is really about. How do we take an idea powerful enough to change the world for the better and turn it into a reality? So with that, let's jump right into this week's conversation with Raja Dhir. Raja, how are you?
I'm doing great.
Yeah, thank you for being here.
It's hard to complain looking out this window here at the Pacific Ocean.
I know. I mean, we are blessed. Yeah. So I've been following what you've been doing for a while, and I've been fascinated with microbiomes and the health, the gut-brain access for a long time. And so I want to definitely hit squarely in this conversation about what you've come to learn and what the insights that you have to help people live better. And I also want to start in the proper order. Like, what got you to want to do this, right? Maybe you're just a businessman that found this like to be an open market that's unexploited, or maybe you really love this industry. I'm not sure yet. So before we pull on that thread, take us back to early life. What was it like growing up? Whatever age you want to start us with.
Let's see. So when the sperm first connected with the egg, there was a flash of zinc. And that was the moment of inception.
Oh, God. Okay. That's your dry humor's coming out already. Okay, good. And so, all right. So where did that sperm and egg happen?
Both my father and my mother come from a lineage of North Indian base Himalayan ancestry. I got a pretty cosmopolitan and international upbringing. My mom grew up basically for the first 10 years of her life on a ship. My grandfather was at a very young age, the captain of an international shipping vessel. And so my mom grew up in the captain's quarters and had visited 50 or 100 or so odd countries before the age of 10, and all kinds of crazy stories that type of exposure has, but also imparts a sense of comfort with solitude and curiosity and tolerance to uncertainty and the unknown, which I think was passed on to me. My father is really analytical. He's an engineer. And so a lot more of that type of rational thinking and taking systems and tweaking them and thinking of things as able to be modified. I think I got a lot from my father. But if you ask them, they'll say that I was an anarchist as a child. Most of my belief systems were self-taught. I found indoctrination to be quite onerous. And that really got to take full flight during my high school years when my mom forced me, and then I became a voracious participant of debate. And by the end of my senior year, I was among the top, and by some rankings, the top debater in the country, which enabled me to get a full ride to undergrad, which, if you ask entrepreneurs, there's kind of a line of thinking in entrepreneurship about whether entrepreneurs are born or made. And I cast my vote in the Entrepreneurs Are Made hat, because if you surround yourself with a lot of really smart, of course you have to have a base level of aptitude. But if you surround yourself with a lot of really smart people and you remove a lot of the typical constraints, like going into debt for college or needing to pick a major that has a certain salary basis, or paying your way through school, for example, your mind, you have your base level of stress is so much lower. It's in a Maslow's hierarchical type of way. And I think that you can incubate. And I mean, I don't think that we build adults anymore. I think we build like adolescents for a very long period of time that need to be incubated in these progressively larger nests. And one such example, I think, is the American university system, which if done well, can be really positive. If done poorly, can be like a very fertile ground for distraction. So I'll pause there, but that's a little bit of a wind in, I guess.
See, we go from zinc to extended wombs. Okay. All right. And what does it mean to grow up in Northern India? Like what is that from a cultural perspective? What does that mean?
Yeah, I visited a couple of times. Some of my grandparents are still there. And
oh, you weren't born there.
I was not. No, I grew up I grew up in the suburbs of Atlanta.
Okay, so mom and dad moved to the U.S.
Yeah, but my mom was early 20s. My dad mid 20s.
Okay, and then so you grew up in Atlanta.
Oh yeah.
Okay, and that was suburbs, you said?
Yeah, for the most part, very small, sleepy town. Most people from that area don't really ever leave that area, but for some strange reason, three of the top 10 debate schools in the country happen to be concentrated in like a 20-mile radius in central northern Georgia. So it was really my ticket out. I mean, I spent summers in different universities at debate institution every week or two, even since I was 13 or 14 years old. I was traveling all over the country to tournaments at Northwestern, Berkeley, Harvard, and
if there was different groups, this is me trying to oversimplify something. There's an athletic group, there's a drama arts group, there's the nerd group, you know, there are, I'm not sure what the goth group, there's the risk-taking kind of whatever group, you know, what group did you, to oversimplify your early years, where'd you fit in?
The nerd group, but of the nerds that also were confident enough to be class clowns a little bit.
Okay, yeah, all right. So you had a little bit of an off-axis humor to you. It wasn't like you knew you were the academic.
Yeah, I wasn't shy though about it. So if someone didn't get my joke, it was kind of just like, well, fuck them.
because
well, I just would still go for it. I mean, is my point. Like,
yeah, okay.
I wouldn't censor myself based off of what I thought the audience around me was. And I think that has helped.
Okay. So at a young age, that level of confidence can flirt easily with hubrism, arrogance. Like it can get, you know, as you're trying to sort it out, were you more on the quiet confidence or more on that hubristic, come try me?
I was very much on the hubristic, overconfident side. And as a result, I was checked a couple of times, and my wings definitely got roasted. They didn't burn off entirely, but they got a little warm.
What does that mean?
Fly too high, your wings burn off reference.
That's right. Yeah. So tell me what actually happened. What does that mean to you is what I want to ask.
I'm trying to think of a specific, I mean, you create a trail of skeptics, or you force yourself to have to deliver more than if you under-promised and over-delivered. And I think a couple breakout narratives will come to me as I think about it. But if conceptually it was more of the, I guess if you don't see failure as, if you don't activate your avoidance systems towards failure in a traditional sense, you become a little bit more tolerant of, you know, things not necessarily going the way that you first anticipated they would be.
Okay, so definitely not rigid. You know, you have a flexible framework to you that you, even from an early age. And when you say you've been roasted, your wings have been roasted, what I was thinking is that there was some sort of hardship story where you fronted somebody in a public place and, you know, you didn't clip your wings, but definitely made it known that, hey, sit in place.
So this might be even more conceptual or meta of a point, but as a testament to how little attention I paid about external cues, those things as singular, isolated, transformative events wouldn't even register in my memory. I'm sure if I really tried, I could find something, but it's not. It's not so linear, I think, in a way. It's
what does occupy your memory?
Gosh, I'm obsessed with biology. I love biology.
So more facts.
Facts, but ways that integrate into shaping worldviews. And so my brother's a doctor, and so I always found the medical school texts to be overly descriptive and detailed in nature. And certainly it's not about cramming your brain with Latin words or progressions that you don't ever need. But I very much try to learn the essential or the vertebrae of a number of different disciplines to anchor and build knowledge around. I'm a firm believer that if you don't assimilate a fact or some information immediately into a web or a tree of knowledge that you're constructing inside your own mind, that it's pretty useless information because it lacks context. And so those are the types of things that I try to build on, whether it be in physics, whether it be in biology, whether it be in, you know, chemistry in some instances, environmental sciences. But I generally lean even psychiatry and psychology. I take a pretty deep interest in maps or patterns that people start building in their head, which then they use as their basis for navigating the world around them. So, I don't know if that answers it, but I really like to encourage people and myself to adopt what I call an essentialist worldview, which is, you know, nothing more, but make sure you get all the bases and then cast a pretty wide net, because the more things that you're pretty good at understanding, the richer the world appears and feels as you work your way through it.
Formal education for you or more self-engineered?
Yeah, most of my scientific and technical nature is autodidactic, but I do have a degree in philosophy and biology. I finished undergrad in 3 or so years and then used the last year to just incubate a couple ideas on my scholarship.
Okay. And it sounds like, you know, you're using language that is refreshing, you know, the vertebrae across disciplines, you know, or principles of interest. It's a really cool phrase. And it sounds like what you're trying to do is create some sort of string theory for the things that interest you most. And I'm interested in your model, right? You're talking about your psychological framework. So let's take an example. Can you think of a time that was incredibly difficult for you?
Look, entrepreneurship isn't anyone who glorifies entrepreneurship.
It's hard.
Yeah.
It's uncertain. It's difficult. There's difficult decisions that involve people and money and product development. It's hard. What's a specific difficult time that you've had?
So prior to founding Seed, which is my current company, I was the co-founder of a food tech company called Vitalamine. And we had a pretty simple goal. We wanted to isolate micronutrients from plant material, and in the perfect embodiment of it, we would find plant biomass that was non-inedible, and basically valorize or salvage.
Non-inedible, which means
that was inedible.
Inedible. Yeah. Non-inedible would mean
edible probably. Okay. Yeah, I'm sure everything's edible.
Okay.
To some extent, but non-nutritive.
Okay, non-nutritive.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, the microbiome has always been my passion, or at least since 2006, when I read a paper that showed that and this was before the field of microbiome science even was a mainstream or a real area of science. And, this was a pretty landmark paper. You took the gut microbiome from an obese mouse and a lean mouse and you switched them and their entire shape changed in a very short period of time. And so I knew that this or gene therapy were going to be areas that I always wanted to get back to, but I didn't want to do bench work.
Okay, hold on. So I don't know if you're going to answer the difficult moment, because I was trying to get to your map, but let me stay here for a minute. Is that when you read that piece of research on the biome, and it was a fecal implant, right?
Yeah.
So they took the fecal matter of one and switched it around and injected into a healthy rat. And then all of a sudden that rat's composition changed
overnight.
And I remember the first time I read it, I was like, what is this? What happened for you when you read that bit of research?
I mean, look, it's your, as a young investigator, it's your dream to find these, and this builds on the systems thing where we started talking about, you know, to find these features that fundamentally change the way you orient yourself around a discipline. Like in this case, it changes the way we think about the nature of biology, right? Like we're more than our genes. We're more than our dietary inputs. The same identical twins could, for the most part, go through life the exact same way and still have very different outcomes based on these organisms that cohabitate with us. And I found it checked all the boxes for me as an area that I wanted to, continue to see through. It had philosophical questions about the nature of self. It had deep scientific and technical utility and applications for human health. It had opportunity for optimization. It gave agency to things that you traditionally would deem inoperable or unable to be modified or adjusted. And so, and lastly, it was starting to draw interest from not just one field. I always thought the way that we broke down the medical sciences was a little strange and actually very unscientific. So I don't know why a doctor should only focus on your nose, ear, and throat, other than the fact that they have proximity to each other. Or, you know, it's a really strange way of organizing ourselves around body site. And so here you found something that came in with and bulldozed that wall down, and you had immunologists, you had microbiologists, you had neurologists, you had gastroenterologists, psychiatrists, and psychologists mm-hmm. as well. People, CNS, like coming and working all together on the same problems and that had a lot of technical and big data and looking at patterns. And it just was such a rich field that I kind of knew. Maybe not today, but you know, it's at some point in my lifetime, hopefully within the next decade, this thing is going to really heat up. And that moment for the field happened in 2015.
Finding Mastery is brought to you by UCAN. One important way to take control of your metabolic fitness is to fuel with foods that help regulate your blood sugar. It's key for your metabolism to work effectively and to maintain sustainable energy levels. So many sports drinks and energy products are filled with sugar or fast digesting carbs. And while those give you a quick flash of energy, it ends up being short-lived and can lead to a crash. UCAN has taken a different approach, and that's why they're loved by so many elite athletes that I know. Their products deliver a sustained release of long-lasting energy that helps you maintain sharper focus, curb hunger cravings, to help you exercise harder without spiking blood sugar. They've developed a patent low-glycemic carbohydrate called Live Steady. It's derived from a complex starch instead of sugar, and its efficacy is backed by extensive research and clinical trials, which I know you love. A few members of the team here at Finding Mastery use UCAN on a regular basis while preparing for marathons and other endurance events, and they've loved it too. They say it's a game changer in their training and performance. Whether you're an intense exerciser or recreationally active or just looking for an energy boost to get you through the day, I hope that you'll consider checking out UCAN as a smarter way to fuel. You can try a variety of UCAN products for free when you head to ucan.co/findingmastery. You just pay for shipping, they'll cover the rest. Again, that's UCAN, spelled UCAN.co/findingmastery. To try a selection of UCAN products for free. Finding Mastery is brought to you by Apollo Neuro. I am really excited about what Apollo Neuro is building. If you haven't had the chance yet, I highly recommend that you go check out the conversation I had with their co-founder, Dr. David Rabin, on the podcast. It is well worth a listen. Unlike traditional wearables that simply track your biometrics, Apollo is doing it totally differently. Apollo Neuro is designed to actively improve your health by enhancing sleep, relaxation, energy, and focus. So how's it work? Developed by neuroscientists and physicians, Apollo delivers these soothing little vibrations. They call them Apollo vibes, that are like music your body can feel. More rapid vibrations help to improve your energy and focus, while the slower vibrations help to promote rest and digest in your body. And the best part for me, they're grounded in good science. Apollo has been tested by thousands of users in clinical and real-world trials. I would love for you to give it a go. It's making a meaningful difference in my life. And because you're listening to this podcast, you can receive an exclusive 15% off an Apollo wearable. Just head to apolloneuro.com/findingmastery and use the code findingmastery at checkout. This is an exclusive offer. It's only for us here at Finding Mastery. So be sure to use the code at checkout. Again, that's Apollo, A-P-O-L-L-O, Apollo, Neuro, N-E-U-R-O, apolloneuro.com/findingmastery, or use the code findingmastery at checkout for 15% off your purchase. You're a systems thinker, first and foremost, right? And a couple of times I've asked, like, because I'm trying to understand, like, how you, what it's like to be inside you, like the thinking patterns, the emotional states, the way that aha moments or challenges take place. And you're very cognitive. You think through things probably clearly and quickly. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so.
So one of your assets is cognition, metacognition even. You know, the log rolling effect where you're able to watch how logs roll on each other and not be necessarily the log.
Yep.
Right? Okay. And so then you spot a trend that sits across other disciplines, cross-pollinates across many disciplines, and not a trend, but a bit of information, sorry. And you go, I'm going to invest my life efforts towards this. But it's, I went thinking about you right now, you probably didn't chip all in. You don't seem like this aggressively, you know, emotionally risk taker. It's like I'm imagining that you thought about it for a bit, but I don't want to presuppose anything. So when you found this information and it made some interesting connections, what did you do then? Walk me through that arc, you know, the main frames of that arc.
Yeah. So this will give you some clues into my arc as well. And it also doubles as advice for budding entrepreneurs. Immediately seek out, find the best in the field and learn what they do in a way where if you had a conversation with them, they would leave that conversation not being able to stop thinking about that conversation. And that's kind of the outcome or the goal. And then the alignment that you need to do to make that a reality will give you the clues kind of to the individual tactical steps. You have to learn, you have to do so much. It's not just about cramming knowledge. It's about explaining it. It's about innovating, having a new approach. Certainly you have to internalize their work, but you also have to be able to then connect it or contextualize or add to it in a way that augments their skill set. So that's...
Okay, hold on. I love that thought. I bet this happens for you a bit. It happens for me too much is that I'll get emails that say, hey, love your work. I'd love to pick your brain. Hey, love your work. I'd love to take you to coffee. I'm like, wait, I mean, that's... I'm running out of time to like do the... like. The deep, meaningful stuff is like I'm trying to figure it out. And I don't want to sound rude, but that's not going to work for me because of, I guess, the interest and the bandwidth.
Be memorable. If you don't invest, God, the amount of free, both me and my co-founder have done so much free shit for other people just to build ourselves into the place we are today. This like quid pro quo type of, or like one-sided relationship with people that you want information or knowledge or life experience from, it just isn't rational. It doesn't make any sense. You have to probably give a lot more. That's why, you know, up until recent times, these things were done under mentors or under tutors or apprenticeships. I mean,
which took a long time to nurture those relationships before you get knighted as an apprentice. Or you got to pay your way into an institution. You got to earn some hoops that way. Yeah. I don't mean just paying in a crass way, but universities are businesses, you know, and you've got to have an academic, this, that, and the other, and a track record, and have money to get into, you know, research institutions. Okay. So I love that insight. Like, create a conversation where the other person is left stimulated. Okay. What else happens? So that's what you did. That's the first thing you did? When you saw a bit of research?
Any new project in my that I've ever started, that's the first place that I go. So I'll put a list together of the people that are the best in the field. And sometimes it'll be years before I actually even reach out to them. But knowing that this venture or this idea or this project won't be successful until I can hang with at least any combination of between 2 to 5 of the people that are on that list.
Okay, pause here. Where do you go next? Do you start to research their work? Do you start to read? Do you write? How do you categorize or systematize your information, and where does it live? Do you have a wiki page? Like, what do you do?
Yeah. So I start with passive learning. And if you have trouble with recall, then I would advise going straight to active learning. But for me, passive learning is kind of like it's like the charcoal filter in like reverse osmosis. It separates out the big stuff. Part that you don't need to go down into anymore. And you just kind of see what sticks after a certain period of time that probes what your next level of investigation is.
In other words, you're
going
to read an article and you're going to say, oh, these are the big boulders I'm interested. Then you follow those threads.
Yeah. And then you chase those all the way down. So I do start with passive learning, although I've heard that some people have different approaches to that.
Because you mentioned active recall, did you say active recall?
Active learning.
If you have challenges with recall.
With recall.
Because recall is a tricky thing for people. And you would probably recognize this, is that it's actually one of the variables for intelligence testing. And it doesn't mean that you're dumb if you can't recall, but people have different aptitudes and abilities for recall. So if you struggle with recall, there's mnemonic devices and strategies to help you engage in a way that makes the recall easier.
You can also work on recall itself.
It doesn't change though.
Really?
Yeah. So it's considered a
fixed. Well,
yeah. So intelligence is a relatively fixed, model, and so it doesn't change over time. But you can amplify your weaknesses and amplify your strengths as well. But so mnemonic devices, creating all different types of systems. You can look all the there's 12 of them. You can look them up online. Okay, good. So you go passive, then you get active, stay passive.
Yeah. And then I go into, an exercise that I use actually, it sounds a little weird, is, I imagine that and it actually happens when like an investor or, an advisor or business partner asks you in an email or kind of a fire drill, how you would explain the most interesting or relevant points with kind of like a plan, like with some thought leadership to it. And so it's an exercise I do a lot. Like if you go to my drafts folder in my inbox, I have like hundreds and hundreds of drafts that I've just written to nobody. Just because when I imagine there being someone on the receiving end of it, I synthesize and I distill down what it is that I've just learned into ways that would allow me to be effective in communicating it, or also cut it down into the minimum viable units of communication.
How often do you distill something that you've read into an email, or just let it kind of permeate in the background for a bit?
Don't do it too close together. Otherwise, you'll be thinking, as you read, you'll be thinking about translating instead of reading. And so it's better if you just, the more time you can, depending on your recall abilities, the more time you can put between it, the better. Because you want to train yourself to read something, learn it, understand it, always stop and chase a word you don't understand, because then you won't integrate it. So if there's words or concepts, don't listen. And my advice would be, don't listen to people that say, just stick to it, make a list and go afterwards and look up all the things you didn't know. I mean, learning is active combat. And so you can take information in passively, which just means that you're not writing or doing anything else and jotting things down. Take notes for sure. But always back to the vertebrae concept, you have to find a notch to hang it around, or you have to find a solar system with a star that has enough gravity that it can then go enter into its orbit. Otherwise, it's just going to be drifting listlessly through space.
I love it. I listen to a lot of audiobooks and podcasts as well. And I can't do it unless I've got my computer out, my phone out, or a notepad. I'm more digital than on paper. But it just seems like as soon as I learn something and it's like, oh, that's a gem, I want to see it. I want to integrate it into my own thought. So that's something that you're doing as well.
Yeah.
Okay. So those are two steps you got. What else are you doing to make sense of things?
I've been going on a lot of podcasts recently and talking about them.
I think it's an interesting response, because when you can put your own words to somebody else's principles and concepts, and you're able to pull on 2, 3, 4 different other ideas, then it starts to become something uniquely yours, you know, and it's a synthesis that makes sense to maybe birth a new idea. Okay. So let's go back to that first research article. You go, oh, this is interesting. You found some folks, you did some reading and some research to be proficient in their domain. And then you do what next?
Then I'm ready to, then you go and battle test your ideas.
With whom?
With the experts, basically anybody that has don't be too strict on how you pressure test those ideas. So another nugget to insert here is people that are too precious about their ideas, I as an investor wouldn't bet on them, because so much of this stuff is on what you gain in pressure testing your own ideas, even in your own internal development and ability to communicate it, far outweighs the risk of idea theft. I mean, unless it's something that's so specialized or particular, or use palladium for this instead of some other rare earth metal, because then it's something that's stealable. But if it's like, hey, I have an idea for a microbiome company that looks at a lot of different organ sites and has partially therapeutics and starts with this and this, this, and this, and this is going to be the first FDA trial. And I mean, no one's going to really, you talk to investors, talk to scientists, talk to leaders in the field, talk to people that have failed before. I'm very precious about my time. And so if I can immediately tell out someone's not going to add value, I'll be a little, I won't be rude, but I'll just cut the discussion short and walk away. But I'll get a lot of opportunities for like a bite, you know, or a hook. And sometimes you'll see someone come in with something fresh or something new or a perspective that's good. So go wide with it, but don't feel compelled to give everybody the whole hour, for example, or give everybody the entire time of day. But then you pressure test it. You battle test it, you harden it, you refine it. And then ultimately the final test is going back to the experts, get into those rooms and have a clear plan on what you want to do next. So I'll give you an example. So now at our company, we work with probably at this stage, we have either on our advisory board or as chief scientists in different divisions of our company, 60 to 70% of the top scientists in the entire microbiome field. And in each one of our individual tracks, we have the expert, usually the leading scientist that's never commercialized their work before, that's published more on the subject than anybody else. These are highly fundable, expert-driven businesses now. And if you want to be successful, you also can't make yourself be the core pressure point between success and failure. And so you almost like when you're building a structure, you distribute the risk across a number of very validated pressure points, and then you scale it up.
Beautiful. Yeah. How many people are on your advisory board?
15 now.
15. And then what is the nature? Do you consider yourself more of an entrepreneur or a science investigator?
I would consider myself more on this. At this stage, it's almost all my time is spent designing clinical trials, publishing papers, evaluating new technical research, designing experiments.
Okay, so you're on the science side more. Okay. And then, because I'm going to ask you I want to get into the science in a minute, but I want to ask you about your advisory role. When you have those experts, it sounds so crass, but what is the give get? So you're giving them a community, and in return, what is it that they're getting?
You're actually not giving them a community. If they're good at what they do, then they usually know or are far more connected and integrated into the scientific community than anything you could ever offer them, which is what makes this so hard, because the only things you can give these people are money, stock, or in some instances, I guess, a path to commercialize their work. But all three are dependent. I mean, for the at least I can only speak on the science side. And I think it breaks in some areas like robotics and computer science and clean energy. You find a lot more commercially oriented investigators. But when you come to biology and material sciences and chemistry and physics is the worst. I mean, these people, the best in the field really don't care about money. Their mindset, if you want to transport into their portal. I mean, these people are driven by coming up with something that has never been thought of or done before. And they're so raw on kind of the end of the create something from nothing spectrum. That sometimes you'll find like a couple of the like powerhouses from like the Broad Institute at Harvard, for example, and MIT is, and some Stanford departments are really good at commercializing, but most scientists are more driven by doing good science than they are about making money. So it's very hard. You really don't have anything to offer other than saying, look, you've now gotten a chance to get to know me. You see what we're doing. You see that we're advancing the field. So you have to align your interests with theirs, that the work that we're doing is accelerating the pace of the field itself. And if we don't do and fund this work, it probably won't get done for a very long period of time, certainly not within academia. And so most of the relationships in our scientific community are with people that say, have a ton of trust in me that something's not going to break down along the way, that their name or research isn't used incorrectly. But ultimately the thing that the best thing you can offer somebody back in return, certainly you should, that's what advisory shares are for, is to give them some kind of some stake in the company. But, the best thing you can offer them is an innovative application of their own work that they may not have thought about before.
Mm, there you go. Very cool. Okay. You know, I've been part of some advisory boards and they're exactly that. For me though, they're a community that I normally wouldn't be part of because I'm looking for communities that have multiple diverse worldviews, scientifically informed views. And so those are the fun conversations and people that I love to be around. And so that's the part that I think with community, but I hear your point, which is I've got my own community. But I want to be part of that other community as well. Okay.
Science is a community. Science is probably, I mean, the whole concept of peer review, in some ways, science is the most foolproof community because the whole concept is that until your peers validate what you've done, now it breaks down a lot. There's a lot of stuff that sneaks through peer review and there's a lot of politics and a surprising amount of the same principles that you find of introducing bias in other disciplines, when taken advantage of, it can actually be worse because it becomes a Trojan horse your bias now gets into a worldview it shouldn't under the pretense of being objective. But when it's done well, it's the most remarkable structure for a community.
Finding Mastery is brought to you by AquaTrue. We all know how important hydration is to performance and recovery and well-being. But it's not just about how much you drink. The quality of your water plays a big role. And if you're like me and you don't fully trust tap water, and I think for good reason, research by the Environmental Working Group has shown that 3 out of 4 homes in the U.S. have harmful contaminants in tap water. That's why I'm really excited to introduce AquaTrue. Their purifiers use a 4-stage reverse osmosis purification process, and their countertop purifiers remove 15 times more contaminants than ordinary pitcher filters. It's incredible. I can literally taste the difference in my water. Plus, the filters are affordable and long-lasting. Just one set of filters from their classic purifier makes the equivalent of 4,500 bottles of water. That adds up to less than 3 cents per bottle. It feels great to know that all at once, I'm saving money, getting the highest quality water for the Finding Mastery team, and helping make a positive impact on the environment by eliminating single-use plastics all the way around. AquaTrue comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and it even makes a great gift. And right now, because you're a Finding Mastery listener, you receive 20% off any AquaTrue purifier. So just go to AquaTrue.com. You spell it AquaTrue.com and enter the code Finding Mastery at checkout. Again, that's AquaTrue.com. Enter the Finding Mastery code at checkout to receive 20% off any purifier that you buy there. Finding Mastery is brought to you by Ritual. They are a supplement company. They just care about what they're doing. They are flat out committed. And they've got this idea that Ritual is made traceable, which means that their products are made with a visible supply chain so that you can see exactly what they're doing, their key ingredients, the supply chain, the research, the whole thing. For companies that are showing you exactly what's on the inside, exactly how they're doing it, so that you know and feel comfortable knowing what you're consuming, I think it's a really nice touch. I think it's required. I think they are setting the standard for supplement companies. The product that I'm using right now that I flat out love is their Symbiotic. It's a 3-in-1 gut health supplement that, you know, microbiome is really important. So I need it. I think that you might benefit from it too, but of course I don't know. Go check out what they're doing. And it just gives me this peace of mind knowing that this is a company, this is a brand that doesn't cut corners. If you haven't had the chance to listen to our Finding Mastery episode with Ritual's founder, Katarina Schneider, I really want to encourage you to go check that out. It's episode 428. She's awesome. It's a fascinating conversation where Kat beautifully describes her story and Ritual's mission. They are investing in their company's quality so that you can invest in the quality of your life. So I want to encourage you to head over to ritual.com/mastery to get 25% off your first month of Ritual. And that's where you can get started on their subscription model. Again, this one's just a little different. It's ritual.com/mastery for 25% off. Okay, how about this? What is your worldview? That's a big question. I'm curious where you might take that.
There's a couple of ways, a couple of places I can take it, but I've been speaking to anybody who will listen recently about I think the human-centric worldview is much like the earth-centric worldview in the 1600s.
Of course you would go here. I mean, you're squarely invested in microbiome,
well,
in organisms.
I mean it biologically, but I also mean it in more, there's other ways of, I think, digging into this one.
This is cool.
So it's yes, from an evolution, from an evolutionary perspective, we are very rare. Organisms like us shouldn't necessarily evolve that often. I get it. It's special. More importantly, we are aware of the fact that we are special. And so that can kind of create this feedback loop of, speciesism or species.
This is something new to me too.
It's just like privileging one species over another, for example.
Cool. You know? Speciesism.
Speciesism.
I've never heard of it. Let's go with it. Yeah.
And
so it's a bias that our species is something special.
Yeah, and I don't, and most of the times when I start this off, people will start rolling their eyes, be like, oh God, he thinks that like factory farming is bad and we're going there. And yes, I do think that that's bad just because it's gross and, you know, it's a weird thing. It's also a weird thing to do, but I understand when there's a purpose, like in medical research, I know why you'd put things in cages, but I'm not going there with this. What I'm going for is that I think that there's the world is a lot more beautiful when you don't need to rely on self-constructed ideas of species of privilege, or on the other end of the spectrum, need to rely on some sort of divine basis or moral imperative for purpose or for why you exist and what you should and should not do. And it's summed up really well with this idea that I forget who said it, but it's like, isn't the garden beautiful enough without having to believe that there's pixies in it too? And that's my worldview is partially based in this idea that look like it's like everything's amazing and no one cares, you know? And I think that when you start to find these common threads, you can synthesize information really well and you have a technical and information-based understanding of the world around you. And this my biggest issue is with pseudo-spiritualism because it has all the looks and feels of a truly valid worldview, but it's devoid of a lot of the substance that makes those things fungible. And so I just encourage, I mean, biology and the concept of like even really simple things like how evolution works, you know, like the concept about how things are constantly tested and then die. People think evolution is this linear progression between small organisms up to more complexity. There's tons of very complex things that have, it's more of like a pulse, like it goes out and then it contracts. And then what's left in the contraction blooms out and then it contracts again. And it's a nucleus out process instead of this like linear march through time. And that's what I mean when I say like human centrism is very much an extension of this like linear forward, the march of progress, industrial type of approach. And it just doesn't serve you from a mental health perspective, nor does it serve you for innovation. It doesn't help you for innovation. You don't come up with good ideas trying to look at the last iteration and figure out where to go in the tree from there. And it doesn't help our planet. I mean, we're pretty close to the next big mass extinction, which is entirely human driven. And so I try to be an evangelist. I think that connecting with non-human life forms in meaningful ways is just all around a pretty good thing to do. It's like one of those things that once you do it, a lot of other stuff just clicks into place.
Mm. There's so much in there. Non-human life form connection, meaning plants and otherwise.
Just life. I mean, life. Sometimes it can even be with like
animals, dirt, whatever it might
like
be.
Like forms of matter. It can be with a body of water, right? Like it doesn't have to be with something which has a nucleus.
And where does spiritualism, religion, where does that fit in your worldview? Is it a artifact of people needing purpose and meaning, or do you have a difference?
No, look, this is kind of a little bit more up your alley. So I've been reading this article in a scientific journal. It's by, I think the lead author was from the Stanford School of Psychology. It's called Some Key Differences Between a Happy Life and a Meaningful Life. And in some ways, happiness, so happiness and meaning oftentimes get conflated, where happiness seems to be a feature of me being, having meaning, right? Or when devoid of meaning, it turns into pleasure. That's usually how people orient themselves with those concepts. I think it's something a little bit simpler. I think happiness is a emotional state which is highly present or oriented in the present. I don't think that like even when you're happy about future things, when the moment like your Christmas presents, when it arrives or a trip that you've planned like months in advance, the happiness isn't felt in that whole period leading up to the trip. It's felt when you actually realize it or in that moment of presence. So I think happiness is this very thin slice. People say it's fleeting as if it's a bad thing, but I think that's just a descriptive term of it. I don't think there's any judgment attached to that word. I think it's a temporary, present-oriented state. Meaning, I think, is an integration of past, present, and future in ways that if it's done correctly, you do also feel some sense of happiness as a part of it. But there's when people say, look for something deeper, look for something more meaningful. All they're saying is like living in a little bit more integrated with the different states of your life, you know, and letting them all kind of reconcile together and deriving fulfillment or positive emotive response from things that aren't present, either fond memories or time with loved one or ideals of your future. And so that's just kind of, I think that spirituality or religion are the most accessible forms of creating meaning in the way I just described it. So I think that they'll give you a system. Look, they check all the boxes. They give you a very long historical series of events that led to what you are today, that resulted in the creation of you. Okay. They put you and your life experience at the center of your journey or path or whatever you want to call it, or life. And then they give you a big, big promise about if based off of the actions that you're doing today of an integration in some future sense, that the cherry on the top is that it even links, but you'll then go back and see all your loved ones and people from your past life and they bring it right back around to the past. I mean, it's the perfect story narrative for meaning in that sense. And it gives you, You know, I heard someone write about it a long time ago. I don't know if I'm going to offend people that are really religious that are listening to this. That doesn't have any, I'm not making any value statements on what's right or what's wrong. I'm just talking about it from like the theoretical devices, how it's constructed. And look, like, I think there's a, it was probably very important in times when the human condition was a lot less bountiful than it is today, when most people would live in squalor or there's poverty was a, and disease and suffering, betrayal. We're all, I mean, look at, read any story from before, even from up until 1960 or so. I mean, that was really the glory days, right? Invention of antibiotics, I would say, is pegged to it. You know, but look, like, even before that, like, if you look at even some of these, like, have you read Beowulf? It's crazy. Life wasn't tough. And certainly during the time of when biblical texts in particular were, you know, most popular, you would need some sort of external value system to help give you a sense, a reason to behave, a reason to not steal from your neighbor, right? Or a reason to not, to be just. So I think that it makes a lot of sense. I understand where it came from. And I think that in some instances it's had a lot of, a very quick, accessible and immediately transferable way of helping people access meaning. And to that extent, I think a meaningful life is indisputably more rich than a non-meaningful life. Now, the question becomes, and to conclude the thought, are there ways of creating a meaningful life which are, more customizable than kind of a more out-of-the-box set? So I think as long as the key attributes or features are felt, like, you'll find people that have found deep, deep forms of meaning by connecting with nature. Nature and evolution also checks those boxes, but it was when too much myth is put around it, it starts to become paganistic, and too much ritual, it starts to become corrupted by the human touch. But in principle, I mean, a lot of these ideas about, look, My final thought on it is, if you are only behaving out of fear that if you don't behave well, something bad will happen to you after you die, I mean, come on.
You are clear in your approach. I mean, I'm so happy that I asked about your worldview. Yeah, right? Okay. So you are, in many ways, a humanist. But then you also have this asterisk, which is, so religionism, you're saying, is dying or is escaped its utility. And you're suggesting that humanism is like, hey, listen, there's ways to create meaning and purpose that is more customizable than out of the box. But you also put an asterisk that, you know, we also get in our own way by thinking that we're the center of the world, and that there are multiple organisms and life forms that are available to us. And, you know, there's something bigger than just our own 9-to-5 job. So, you know, to oversimplify. So where do you go to, let's use that as a bridge and a link into the science, the applied nature of your science, which is, I'm fascinated with microbiomes, that we've got organisms that live in us and on us, and some are healthy, some are not. And the ones that are healthy, the two basic strains, maybe you can walk us through those, are fascinating as ways to manipulate, or I don't know what's the better word here, to maybe it is manipulate, you know, better states of optimization by playing with these organisms. So walk us through the applied science and why you're so excited about Seed, your company, but also the application of microbiome.
Yeah. So just to give some context to everybody. So the microbiome is the entire collection of microorganisms. It includes bacteria, it includes virus, it includes fungi, archaea. And you get your first exposure when you're born is through, we believe, the mother's birth canal and through breastfeeding. And a pretty incredible fact is that about a third of the carbohydrates in breast milk are actually not used by the baby as a food source. They can't be broken down by human enzymes. And they're exclusively nutritive sources for developing bacteria in your early stages of life. And to kind of, if you think about how metabolically expensive it is to make that. When a woman's pregnant, she can't hunt, she can't forage. You know, there's another life that's dependent on it. You know, it's pretty challenging. It's,
and her body's making organ, is making the substrate for organisms
for bacteria.
Yeah. Crazy.
You know? So yeah. To me, it's a complete mind bending thought, which is,
and are those lactobacilli? Is
that, those are bifidobacterium.
Bifidum. Okay. Yeah. Okay. And then, so can you walk us through the two of those?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, wait, hold on. Let's simplify this thought first, right? Which is, the cost to make bacteria is enormous. And for some reason, we're passing bacteria. Mothers are passing bacteria to children.
Well, they're everywhere. We're living in a microbial world. It's a feedback, constant feedback. Everything you touch, everything you, I mean, when you swim in the ocean is after the extremely complex community of microorganisms. It's this giant broth, right? Soil is as dense in most fertile soils, as dense and teeming with microorganisms as the human gut is. And about a third of all the metabolites that are going through your bloodstream are made by bacteria that are living inside of you. This field of science has been implicated. I mean, last year, Jerome Reyes and his group in Belgium published on people that have depression, anxiety, and found that they're deficient in two organisms in their gut in 1,000-person-plus cohort. One of the leading technology and biotech companies right now is working in a phase 2 trial for Alzheimer's disease by blocking a bacterial metabolite from entering into the brain that induces the immune response.
I read both of those.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, like, my hair stands up when I think about how revolutionized,
yeah,
or how revolutionary this idea is, that a living organism that's inside of us is required, is the extrapolation that I'll make there, required,
yeah,
for health.
Yeah. And I know that your background's in cognitive science and psychology. And so as someone, I mean, I'm fascinated by the brain because we're starting to see all these things that we always thought are sterile aren't necessarily sterile anymore.
No, it's way dirtier than that, isn't, yeah, it? Yeah.
And so I don't want to talk too much about the outcomes because it's still in development. But one of the things our company is doing is we're working with the NIH, and we're conducting the first whole spectrum study to evaluate whether there's bacteria in the brain or not. And
you'd be the first there.
We to show it in human brain tissue. Yeah. We would be the first to pub. Look, if it's there, if it's not, we're getting brain tissue samples from fresh from surgery, from brain surgery. People that have never had surgery before, it's the first time that they're getting brain tissue for the last.
So it wasn't introduced by a foreign substance prior. Yeah, yeah. So it's a first brain tissue that's, you know, it's
of
amazing.
Live humans, not dead when, yeah, the, right, immune system breaks down and bacteria, right, can infiltrate live human brain tissue. For the last 6 months, we've been collecting 1 to 2 samples per week.
Oh my God.
You know,
have you heard the phrase air on the brain, never the same?
No.
Yeah. One of my friends is a neurosurgeon. He's like, Mike, once you open it up, like, people just change, yeah, and we're not sure why, but, you know, think about that thought, air on the brain, never the same. So as soon as he cracks open a skull for all the right reasons, that, and he does a beautiful job on surgery, that the person fundamentally is not the same. Something happens.
Yeah.
Is it bacteria? I don't know. Is it literally, well,
we'll
air?
Get,
I
mean, we'll get the answer to that because we're going to get enough that we can cluster people out that, it's their first versus they've had it before.
Yeah,
so
cool.
We know that it's sterile in our processes because we're controlling for it. Hopefully next time we talk, I'll have some more to share on that. But to kind of go back to the point, like, it's, you name it. I mean, one of the research tracks in our company is on preterm birth. It's, I mean, millions of babies each year are born preterm and they have lifelong consequences and puts enormous economic and psychological toll on families and the healthcare system. And the solution could be as simple as changing the vaginal microbiome, which gives cues or signals to the fitness landscape of a baby when it's born back to the mother, to the host. And so we're finding that the mission of our company is to have applications of bacteria where they can become or replace the primary standard of care. So we look for these unmet medical
ingestion?
Needs.
Through oral ingestion?
Not always, no. So
fecal ingestion?
Oral, in some vaginal for our women's health track. For our oral health track, you induce colonization subgingivally. So wherever the target is, that's where we introduce it.
Okay. Very cool.
Yeah.
Yep. And then are you down to the level of knowing the strands that you think might have the most influence?
Now we're way past that now.
So, yeah.
So now, for example, in our women's health, in our women's health company, over the last 15 years, thousands of women have been sequenced, studied, observed, their medical and personal history has been tracked. And we found over these thousands and thousands of samples, some key genomic features that separate stable and healthy from unstable and unhealthy vaginal microbial communities. So it's not just about knowing which species or which strain, and that's like just your ticket to entry. If you really want to start altering these systems to improve human health, you need tons of data, you need to track people over long periods of time, and then you need to show that you can induce a long-term persistent change in that ecosystem after your intervention. And so these are things that aren't, you can't just do them very quickly.
What do you think of probiotics that people go get at Whole Foods or fill in the blank, you know, health store? What do you think about that?
Well, I'm very skeptical. I think most of the probiotics that are available in grocery stores or pharmacies are, I know what they are because they come from the same three or four manufacturers of bacteria domestically. There's only a couple of them, and half of them are relics of the dairy industry when they found that their starter cultures could be used in different ways. And you might experience some very moderate benefits from those, but the only real mechanism that we know is that they produce a little bit of lactic acid. And if that's what you're after, then you're better off just going for a yogurt or something else, which is not considered probiotic. It's actually considered a fermented food, and the two are very different.
Why are most of the tested, I'm thinking of what's the yogurt, Yokum? No, what's the brand?
Yakult.
Yakult.
Yeah.
That most of the probiotics actually have culture attached to them, the ones that are tested.
You mean they like say there's X number of live organisms or something like that? Well,
Is it more of a delivery mechanism?
No. I mean, it could be true, but that doesn't mean anything, right? So there's some strains where a very small amount, like a couple hundred million live cells can deliver a therapeutic effect.
Okay.
And then there's others where they don't do anything at all. And so you find like hundreds of billions because the idea is that by brute force, they'll go. I mean, it's just guesswork, you know? By definition, to be a probiotic, you should have your strains need to be studied in some way. And it doesn't, ideally, it's in a human population, but you have to have a mechanism, you have to have a feature, you have to have some desired outcome. You know, there needs to be some rationale for why that strain was selected, other than the fact that it's just bacteria. So the idea that just being bacteria is enough to be considered probiotic is a marketing myth. So.
Okay, cool. Because you bring up a point that I get concerned about is when some athletes are taking probiotics and there's, an enhanced lactic acid response that takes place, which is the last thing an athlete wants. I mean, we're doing everything we can to
clear lactate.
Say it again.
To clear lactate.
That's right. Yeah. So can you just quickly speak about the dangers of athletes taking probiotics that have a high lactase inside it?
Yeah, I don't know. I'd have to my knowledge, a lot of localized gut lactic acid doesn't have...
It's not a systemic issue.
Doesn't have long-term buildup or certainly... And I think most of the lactate clearance in elite athletes is actually aggregates in muscle tissue.
It does.
Yeah. So you're not going to find...
It doesn't cross over.
No, it's not going to go from your gut and then start to build up in your muscles. So that's not a concern necessarily.
How certain are you on that? And I'm not trying to trick anyone, but like I've had the thought that could be a problem, but I can't find research either way on that.
Yeah. So what I can tell you is at least in our model systems, most of that lactate is used up very quickly by other bacteria most of it actually just serves to lower the pH of your gut.
Got it. Okay.
And it doesn't, it's not in sufficient enough quantities, nor does it make sense biochemically for it to go. I mean, if it does, it would be a wild observation.
Okay, cool. All right, cool. All right. Keep rolling. Like, stitch us into this domain here. Like, if we could flip into the psychobiotic category, right? Like the gut-brain health mechanism. And if we can go, if we could move from start with anxiety, depression, and then move into optimized states of flourishing.
Yeah.
And where probiotics as well, play and how they play.
So I think that the only convincing study I've seen on depression or anxiety is, look, you'll find a bunch of studies that have been done, but if you look a little bit deeper, they looked for 10 different things and they only found one and a secondary thing, and they twist the study to say, well, it worked on symptoms of sad mood. Or mood reactivity, or they'll go tease out whatever of the 50 things that they asked about that got significance just right under the barrier. But nothing on the market has actually been developed for depression or anxiety when given to a adult that we know of to date. I'm very hesitant to say that there's anything that has validity, and we've looked at everything and evaluated this research very closely. However, the Jerome Reyes paper that was published in Nature, these are not commercially available probiotics, but they could be in the future. And in this case, it's the perfect study design. So you look in, it's what we did with our women's health company essentially, but for the brain. So you find thousands of people and you cluster them into groups and you see if there's anything between the two groups that are depressed or not depressed that's different. And then you control for all confounding variables. So in this case, you have to control for antidepressants or anything else of the sort, SSRIs. Then you find what it is. Say, okay, so in this instance, the bacteria that were deficient are two organisms called Coprococcus and Dialister. Then you go and see if you probe the mechanism on what about these organisms could actually have a role in mental health. And in this case, they found hundreds of neuroactive metabolites being pumped out and produced by these exact same organisms that we previously didn't know before. And this is more than just like GABA or, you know, serotonin. It's a myth that gut serotonin makes it into the brain because it doesn't. All serotonin that's used by the brain as neurotransmitters is produced locally.
So what happens, the serotonin receptors in the gut, what's happening?
They're just used as local signaling receptors for a range of just like gut motility. And we don't know every single role that they're playing. I mean, maybe it's possible that they send, they can downregulate or upregulate certain genes based on being expressed, but that hasn't been fully investigated. But then you go, and now the next step of this research is now, so then you take those organisms or their metabolites and you put them back into people that have depression, anxiety, and you see if it works compared to placebo. And so that's kind of how good science is really done. No one's kind of, we're the microbiome field is at the very early stages of, most people are like either at step one or in some instances have now made it to step two. But all of our paths in our company are at stage two now, going back into stage three, or have passed stage three, where you put it back into people and you show that it works for something.
Very cool. So if people are struggling with anxiety or depression, what would you suggest when it comes to probiotics?
I would not advise any probiotics for anxiety or depression. Unless indigestion is a comorbidity. And you find this in people like with autism disorder, where if you fix their gut, you have a tremendous effect on their quality of life because you've removed like a deep-seated latent trigger for negative mood or emotion. Or sometimes you can get, if you have stimulation in your gut, it's processed by the body as anxiety, but it's not anxiety in the way that I think it's diagnosed clinically.
Okay. Okay. So then let's jump just a little ahead. And there's two things I want to figure out. One is, in the most simple terms, how does this ecosystem of gut work? Like, how does this work? And then what can people do based on your science, but your product base, to make their life better, enhance the quality of life?
So I think there's very, now to argue against myself, I think there's few things that people can do to improve their quality of life that are more effective than impacting your digestion, because it's a daily physiological process. Some people just get so accustomed to the way that their system works that they don't actually realize that they don't have optimal or perfect digestion. I mean, in fact, with our, at least our first product is a cocktail of bacteria primarily targeting improvements in digestion. And there's a number of different markers that were evaluated. But what most people report is that I didn't realize that I was had this or that or indigestion or bloating or slow intestinal transit time or my stool consistent or I didn't have ease of expulsion or, you know, there's a number of different factors. And until you really adjust and take it and then you say, well, I just kind of recalibrated and my baseline had become my current, my previous state. And then when you try it, stick to it for a month or two or 12 weeks is the optimal period of time to notice, I think, these changes.
At for least. A probiotic.
For a new probiotic, yeah. Mm-hmm. Most people like, there's a very low like placebo response past 12 weeks, right? Because at that point it either...
The sugar pill wears off. Yeah, right. Okay.
And so, you know, I think that it's an important one. I think there's probiotics are one, but I think that like... magnesium is a really interesting micronutrient that a lot of people are deficient in. I think that avoidance diets and some not to be too extreme, but cutting out processed foods is a phenomenal easy first step that you can take. You don't realize those things affect you for a couple days off of just in a single acute dose. We just completed a trial right now where we looked at the effect of alcohol, ethanol in high quantities has on your gut barrier.
I want to know nothing about this.
Well, it's as we start probing new effects that probiotics have on the gut, we looked at ethanol and we looked at antibiotics. And we found that our cocktail of probiotics has a rescue effect on the gut for after ethanol consumption and a resurgence in production of normal physiological function after an acute dose of antibiotics. So we're starting to interrogate more and more ways.
Which means if you have healthy or using your product or if you have healthy probiotic nature or makeup, then when you take alcohol, there's a...
Disruption.
It's a disruption.
Yeah.
But there sounds like there's also a benefit.
No, it's the opposite. It's that if you take alcohol... if you consume ethanol, it'll have a disruptive effect on both your intestinal cells as well as your resident microbiome in the dosages that we studied. So equivalent of in a 24 to 48 hour period of time, like between 7 and 9 drinks.
So how do people that want to also take alcohol, how do they...
That's what I was saying. So we actually interrogated our hypothesis was that we know that our cocktail of bacteria work by stitching up your gut barrier, right? Mm-hmm. So that's one of the things that previously we've validated. So we wanted to see whether under this specific trigger, we could actually have a rescue effect. And by taking probiotics alongside these stressors, you could attenuate or improve recovery time. And on both of those endpoints, we saw a dramatic improvement.
That's what I thought. Okay, yeah. Very cool. And so I always got, I didn't know the research on this, so I'm glad that we're talking about this. If I have to take an antibiotic, which I don't want to, if I have to take an antibiotic because whatever reasons, also take a probiotic?
Yes. Well,
you know what my thought was? I don't want to take a probiotic while I'm taking an antibiotic because I'm going to promote the whatever bad bacteria that I've got running around. Mm. And I think it felt too simplistic, but you're suggesting if I'm taking an antibiotic at the same time, stay with the probiotic course.
Not just to our knowledge, we are the first company to ever validate this mechanism in this way. So I can't generalize. But it is, we're going to be publishing on this very shortly. So,
awesome.
Yeah.
So you got some good
data.
Okay. Yeah. Very cool. All right. So then last little bit here, I want to thank you for your time. Thank you for
having me. It's been really
fun. The quality of this conversation. What would you suggest people could do? And let's go 2, 3, 4 things, whatever, to improve the quality of their life. And let one of them be something that you have spent your life developing, you know, your products. Like I'm happy to understand that as well, but otherwise, like that and otherwise, what would you suggest?
Yeah, no, do? I mean, if I as much as I love the company we've built and our first product, I don't think it's an appropriate answer to your question of total life-changing, transformative things. The only plug I'll give is that if you want better digestion or GI function or have some sort of issue with transit time or intolerance of certain foods, or you don't have clean, one log, soft, 0-to-1 wipe stool bowel movements on a day-to-day basis and would desire that, go to seed.com and try the product. But that's not an answer to your question. A couple things that I think all around would improve the value of day-to-day living is, this is a little hypocritical because I say it all the time, but I never do it. But when I do it, I just feel incredibly good. Cold exposure. Mm. So a couple times, we live in Southern California, and so we don't get that here. We have a very basic, kind of steady state temperature. And so it doesn't have to be ice baths or cold showers if you're not tolerant of it. But prolong, let yourself get cold. In Iceland, they take infants and they put them in strollers. And when the parents and adults are inside warming up, they leave them outside in the frigid cold. It's been a custom in Iceland for hundreds of thousands, if not thousands of years. And this is based off of scientific data and not just ancestral or historical, but I also just anecdotally and empirically, I feel phenomenal after exposure to cold therapies and certainly cycling of sauna and ice plunge and sauna and ice plunge as is done in Russia, as it's done in most of all of Scandinavia are associated with high quality of life and more just on less about kind of the longevity side of it, but just on your acute change in mood that you feel from exposure to cold and subsequent return back to baseline. So try to expose yourself to cold a little bit more. I think that diet and nutrition is a cornerstone of a high quality life. I would encourage people to completely fill their plates 70% or more with cruciferous green vegetables. And then whatever you want to fill the rest with, as long as it's not processed, just do it. Just go for it and see how you feel. You'll feel amazing. And then the third is digital detox. We don't really appreciate, and of course, as a generalization, but we're as a stimulus-seeking beings, which served an advantage prior to our hijacking of those pathways in our brain, we were a lot more sensitive. If people are familiar with the concept of insulin resistance and insulin sensitivity, I think that we're becoming emotionally insulin type resistant in many ways. And so by forcing a detox, you're actually giving more power to it than I think it deserves. The best would be digital ambivalence, but that's not really possible in the world that we live in. So aspire for digital ambivalence, but at least purge yourself with digital detox when you can. And nature is a really good thing that you can fill that void with, I think.
Awesome. Appreciate you, brother. Really well done. I the depth of thought and the breadth of integration is refreshing. And so thank you for your time.
I appreciate that. I really do.
Yeah. Thank you for your time. Thank you for the insights. And then folks that are interested in Seed, it's SEED.com.
Seed.com.
And I'm looking forward to watching the trajectory of your company.
Thank you very much.
See when you go.
Yeah. And I will send over all the fun, interesting things related to gut brain access that come across my desk because it's a hot field to watch. So
it is. Yeah. Appreciate you.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Thank you so much for diving into another episode of Finding Mastery with us. Our team loves creating this podcast and sharing these conversations with you. We really appreciate you being part of this community. And if you're enjoying the show, the easiest no-cost way to support is to hit the subscribe or follow button wherever you're listening. Also, if you haven't already, please consider dropping us a review on Apple or Spotify. We are incredibly grateful for the support and feedback. If you're looking for even more insights, we have a newsletter we send out every Wednesday. Punch over to findingmastery.com/newsletter to sign up. This show wouldn't be possible without our sponsors, and we take our recommendations seriously. And the team is very thoughtful about making sure we love and endorse every product you hear on the show. If you want to check out any of our sponsor offers you heard about in this episode, you can find those deals at findingmastery.com/sponsors. And remember, no one does it alone. The door here at Finding Mastery is always open to those looking to explore the edges and the reaches of their potential so that they can help others do the same. So join our community, share your favorite episode with a friend, and let us know how we can continue to show up for you. Lastly, as a quick reminder, information in this podcast and from any material on the Finding Mastery website and social channels is for information purposes only. If you're looking for meaningful support, which we all need, one of the best things you can do is to talk to a licensed professional. So seek assistance from your healthcare providers. Again, a sincere thank you for listening. Until next episode, be well, think well, and keep exploring.